Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
The Spanish government announced yesterday it was ordering its 1,300 soldiers out of Iraq. In announcing the withdrawal, just hours after taking office, Spain's newly elected Prime Minister, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, made good on his key campaign pledge. But the timing of the announcement was a surprise. Prime Minister Zapatero had indicated he would wait and see what role the UN might have in Iraq after the handover of power, scheduled for June 30th, before making his final decision. I'm joined on the line from Madrid by Giles Tremlett of Britain's Guardian newspaper. Giles, tell me about the timing of this decision. Spain's decided to withdraw its troops because it thinks the UN will not be playing a significant role in Iraq anytime soon.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's not just a significant role thereafter. They want a controlling role in all senses. There's been a lot of shuttle diplomacy between the foreign minister and the defense minister. They've been all over the world talking to people, and they've come to the conclusion that there will not be a United Nations decision of the kind that they would like. In other words, a complete handover of both military and political power. And that the US and Britain, neither of those countries would be prepared to put their troops under a UN military commander.
Now, what's the initial response in Spain been to this?
This is quite a popular measure in Spain. I mean, if you think that 90% of Spaniards were against the Iraqi war, that one of the reasons Mr. Zapatero won the elections was because he pledged to bring the troops back, that the decision to put them there in the first place was taken without consulting the Spanish parliament. This is a decision that has the backing of every single party in parliament, barring the one that used to govern Spain, which is the People's Party.
Now, Spain also has troops in Afghanistan. Is there any talk of bringing Spanish troops home from Afghanistan?
Absolutely not. Spain has more than 2,000 troops at the moment in different places, in Afghanistan, in Kosovo, in half a dozen other countries. And all those are serving United Nations or other peacekeeping forces. And Spain is saying absolutely it is not going to take them back. In fact, it has suggested that it might boost its force in Afghanistan.
So have there been any comments about what this might do to Spanish diplomatic relations with the U.S., which have been close under the previous Prime Minister, José María Aznar? Is there some concern that it will now begin to rival France as the European country most despised by some Americans in Washington?
This is something that, that the new Spanish government has already assumed might happen, but it's a pledge that it made to the electorate, and it's decided to stick with it. If it has to pay a cost in terms of its diplomatic ties with the United States, then so be it. The previous Prime Minister, Mr. Aznar, was on record as saying that he wanted George Bush to win a second term in office. The new Prime Minister, Mr. Zapatero, is on record as saying that he wants Kerry to win.
Is there any sense of the timeline on the withdrawal of these 1,300 Spanish troops?
Not really. I was talking to some senior government officials yesterday, and they were being absolutely close-mouthed about that. They didn't want to say. There's some suggestion that it might start in the next couple of weeks. They did say that the main Spanish base at Diwaniya is just an 11-hour drive from Kuwait. So the suggestion was that really, you know, they could start anytime.
Giles Tremlett, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Giles Tremlett is correspondent for Britain's Guardian newspaper in Madrid.
Hamas has appointed a new leader, but won't say who it is. Former Hamas leader Abdelaziz Rantizi served barely 24 days as head of the radical Palestinian group before he was killed Saturday by Israeli forces. His death followed the killing of Hamas founder Sheikh Ahmed Yassin last month. Some Israeli officials think Hamas has been hobbled, unable to follow through on retaliation. Others say a large counterattack is inevitable. Joining us on the line from Jerusalem is Ken Ellingwood, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And Ken, you attended the funeral for Rantizi yesterday. What did you see?
Well, it was a massive demonstration of backing for Hamas and anger toward Israel and the United States. A lot of people hold the U.S. Responsible because of its alliance and support for Israel for the assassination of Frantisi.
Specifically because of the meeting this week between Prime Minister Sharon and President Bush, did Palestinians say to you that they felt that that was the green light?
They did. They said it. They said it all day long, and they made it very clear as the crowds, and there were tens of thousands of people crowding the streets of Gaza City as they moved through the city with Rantisi's body. They believe, despite the U.S. denials, that the U.S. government gave the green light to Israel to go ahead and to kill Rantisi.
Mm. As we mentioned, the new Hamas leader is going to remain nameless. Do we have any sense?
Yeah.
Do we have any sense of who he might be?
No, they talked about a short list of possible candidates. One of those people is another physician named Mahmoud Zahar. I spoke with him yesterday at the funeral, and asked him point blank whether he was the new leader, and he declined to comment, saying that the new leader was going to remain a secret. So they obviously are concerned about Israel, going after the next new leader, and they don't want to name that person publicly.
We understand that the leadership of Hamas in Syria insisted that that be an anonymous appointment, and there's some speculation that the leadership of Hamas has pretty much moved to Syria. What does that mean for what's next?
Well, it makes for a pretty complicated picture. The likelihood is, or the possibility is, that the foreign leaders of Hamas will take a more important role. That complicates matters for Israel in how to combat Hamas. If they decide to launch a missile strike by helicopter against the Hamas leadership in Syria, as opposed to in Gaza, which it occupies, then that's attacking in a foreign country on foreign soil, and that clearly makes for a much more complicated and potentially dangerous kind of scenario.
And briefly, Ken, with that in mind, what's the sense in Jerusalem? Are people bracing for retaliation?
Yeah, it's been a pretty edgy time since the Yassin assassination. There was a period where people weren't going to the shopping mall, they weren't riding on the buses, they were fearing a suicide bombing in some public place. They eventually sort of turned back to normal life, and during the Passover holiday here, there were a lot of Israelis out enjoying the countryside, enjoying the time off. But there is very, very tight security still around the country, and the Israeli government said they will stay on a high alert until at least the end of this month, in hopes of averting any kind of disastrous attack.
Mm. Ken Ellingwood, thank you.
Thank you.
Ken Ellingwood, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke to us from Jerusalem.
Two American women, prison guards serving as part of a UN peacekeeping mission in Kosovo, were killed, and nine other Americans and an Austrian were wounded Saturday when one of their colleagues, a Jordanian national, opened fire on them. The Jordanian was also killed when the Americans returned fire. UN police have detained four other Jordanian guards for questioning. The dead Americans were finishing their first day of work at the UN-run prison in Mitrovica. Earlier, we reached Reuters correspondent Douglas Hamilton over a very bad phone line in Belgrade. We asked him to explain what happened Saturday.
Well, it seems that a convoy of including a convoy of about 21 prison guards who'd been undergoing their early training, including mostly Americans, but there was an Austrian, I believe two Turks. They were leaving a UN compound in Mitrovica when the shooting started. According to the UN police commissioner, Stefan Feller, who's a German, it seems that one of a group of about five Jordanian officers opened fire on the Americans. The UN says it doesn't know the reason why, but the net result of what then ensued was a 10-minute firefight in which no fewer than 11 people were injured, 10 of them Americans, plus the Austrian, and two American women officers were killed, and the Jordanian who opened fire. It's not sure if only one Jordanian opened fire or others did, but four are now in detention and have been questioned this morning by the United Nations in Kosovo.
Well, one of the early reports indicated that this gunfight erupted out of an argument over America's presence in Iraq. Can you confirm that?
Well, the jury is still very much out on what the real motivation for the shooting was. Certainly, that report went around very quickly, and I've seen it from numerous sources, but no official source is saying anything about the motive, certainly not the United Nations at this point. But indeed, police sources, including some police we believe were on the spot, said that Iraq and a bad feeling about Iraq was the motive. One police spokesman has said on the record that there was no verbal exchange before the bullets started flying.
Douglas, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Reuters correspondent Douglas Hamilton joined us from Belgrade. We apologize for the quality of the phone line.
It's unlikely any records, heat or time, will be broken in today's 108th running of the Boston Marathon. Temperatures are now in the mid-70s here in Boston. Back in 1976, they reached 95 degrees. And as to time, well, runners might hold back today. Officials have told them to run safely and smartly. It's supposed to go into the 80s. Well, joining us from the finish line in Boston is WBUR reporter Alex Ashlock. And Alex, it's hot out there, no matter how you put it. What precautions have officials taken?
Well, Robin, there are extra, not extra water stops, but there's extra water at the 26 aid stations along the 26-mile course. Red Cross is also doubling the usual amount of ice on hand, 80 pounds at each of the Red Cross stations that are along the race route. And all weekend long, the organizers of the race have been advising runners to take extra water, take extra fluids going into the race, and then drink early and often during the race itself.
And we understand that local fire departments along the way for the first time have opened up the hydrants and are spraying everybody. But there's also been another big change this year. Tell us about the elite women's start.
For the first time ever, the elite women started before the men. That means they'll finish before the men as well down on Boylston Street in downtown Boston. They started about 45 minutes ago. And they're well past 10 miles, at least well past 6 miles in the race so far. And Ethiopia's Elfenish Elemu is leading that race at this time. So it's a big change for the women. It puts them in the spotlight for the race today, the 108th running of the Boston Marathon.
Right. They don't have to elbow away those guys who always tried to get in the camera shot with them. Well, this is also supposed to be a preview for the Olympic marathon, you know, held in Greece later this year. So tell us a few of the favorites to look for.
Well, Catherine Dereba of Kenya is a two-time Boston Marathon champion. She's running today. She's not in the lead right now, but she will be on the Kenyan Olympic team.
Mm-hmm.
The Olympics, of course, will be held in Athens this year. It'll be a hilly course, point-to-point, very much like Boston. So it is a good. This race is a good preview for that race, although some of the men who will be running in Athens are not here, particularly the American men who have already run their Olympic qualifying race this year. So they're not here today.
Well, Alex, thanks very much. I know you got a good position at the finish line. Enjoy.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you. WBUR reporter Alex Ashlock from the finish line of the Boston Marathon.
Just ahead, lip reading and crime busting. A deaf woman uses her special skill in the former to help the FBI in the latter.
And later, by the rude bridge that arched the flood, reenacting the battles of Lexington and Concord.
There's more coming up, here and now. I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Sue Thomas can't remember ever hearing. She suddenly became deaf at 18 months old, and since there was no deaf school in Youngstown, Ohio, Sue learned to speak, before she learned to sign, by working with a speech therapist. She also discovered an unusual talent for lip reading and soon became a special assistant to the FBI. Sue's story is the subject of a new television show, Sue Thomas, FBI, on PAX Television, and she joins us in the studios. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We should say now that we are communicating by you reading my lips.
Yes.
Yeah. And I understand that you learned how to speak by putting your hand on the vocal cords of a coach teacher.
Right. Basically, sitting in front of the mirror, watching my therapist move her mouth, it was my job to move my mouth the exact same way she did. And then I would put my hand on her throat to feel the vibration. Immediately after getting those vibes, my hand would be on my own throat trying to imitate those same vibes.
And you became an extraordinary lip reader, as we said. And end up at the FBI. Now, I understand that you'd first gone to the FBI to teach deaf people to help work with fingerprints.
Yes.
And then agents came to you because they'd shot a surveillance tape and the audio failed. So they asked you to read the lips?
Right.
What was that? Do you remember what were the bad guys doing?
Basically, I can't reveal any of the cases that I worked on, and I regret that. Everybody wants to get a case out of me.
Yeah.
And basically, if I reveal anything, I'm going to have the FBI on my case, so we just don't reveal anything. All the cases does mostly with white-collar crime. So we're dealing either with drug-related embezzlement. Okay, what I did was for surveillance work only, where I could be with someone, see them in the restaurant, follow their conversation, and then give the information to the FBI by saying, okay, he's going to see Mr. Jones 3 o'clock on White Street next Monday. That way, they didn't have to tailgate this guy 24 hours a day. We just told him where to show up as far as that.
And what would you do? Because you're looking at me pretty intently right now. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering how Mr. Jones felt about this woman. You know, how would it work?
Well, people always say, did you really run down the street catching the bad guys? And I've always responded, do I look like I ran down the street catching the bad guys? I didn't have to run down the street catching the bad guys. I could just simply sit and watch the conversation unfold. Yeah. There would be an airport, there would be a restaurant. There would be times where the camera was concealed in a van while people were walking down the street. They were getting it on film. So every imaginable way where a conversation is taking place, we're getting it. When I first realized I had the gift of reading lips, basically, you give me a pair of field glasses, you can put me in one building, I'll look into the next building, and if I can see their lips, I can read them, I can give you the conversation. Okay?
Really?
It's a unique gift. It came about by sitting in front of that mirror, learning to speak. But it is a gift. I used to think that all deaf people could read lips as good as I can, and that's not the case. And yet I also believe that there's people out there that even do it better than I can do it, as far as that. But because it is a gift, and it can be one that could be used as an invasion of privacy, very early in life, I made the commitment to myself that I would never, ever repeat what I saw. Because it is an invasion of privacy. Okay, mm-hmm. People have no idea what can be taking place when I'm there, and I'll look away before I really get into it. Okay, I just won't do it.
Well, but I wonder, too, I mean, in addition to hearing that the bad guys were going to meet and maybe carry out a crime, were you hearing things that made you uncomfortable ever? Were you seeing things, I should say, that made you uncomfortable ever?
Oh, sure. I mean, basically, there's things that I wish that I've never seen before, as far as that. Okay, you do not want to be in an airport and be watching a conversation of basically a man and a woman, okay, that are departing, okay, their life for the next couple of weeks. Don't even get into that conversation, okay? It can be totally embarrassing, as far as that. You just look away. I don't want to see them.
It's so interesting because there are some people that have the problem of, you know, voices. I'm sorry, I turned away. I shouldn't have done that. I'm sorry. It's so interesting because there are some people who have the problem of voices in their heads. You have the problem of words in your head because you see them. It must be noisy as all get out in your head, if you allow it.
I sleep real good at night, okay? What most people don't realize is to read lips, it takes a great deal of concentration. But it's also very important for people to realize that I am not 100% foolproof. Full mustache, a full beard. I couldn't see the lips. I couldn't read the lips.
What else makes it hard to read lips?
You have articulation. Mm-hmm. Basically, if we're dealing with an accent of any type, I can be in a room and I can be watching somebody and I'll pick it up immediately that person either has had a recent stroke or aphasia. I can tell by their lips what's going on. Yeah. But for the most part, if I can get them, I get them.
Yeah. Did you help put bad guys away?
We had one situation. It was a high profile government official. And basically, before I went in to do that case, they warned me that I would be surprised, okay, and that it would be E10, but to kind of just stay with it. And I put the film on, and I saw the person on the tape, And I just about flipped out because it was a very high government official. And basically, we were dealing with embezzlement and drugs. And when they brought that suitcase in filled with all that money, and they had the other suitcase with all the drugs, and I saw this government official doing the interacting and exchanging, it was one of the most shocking days of my life. So, yes, there were days, okay, that were just a little bit different than others. I'll never, ever reveal the government official
name. I was just, I'm thinking, Marion Barry, I'm thinking, who could it have, but you're reading my lips, but yours are sealed. Sue, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Sue Thomas, who became a special assistant to the FBI because of her lip reading skills.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a new study on antibiotic resistance in chickens. It may have implications for farming and for other people.
And a honky-tonk photo exhibit features some of the biggest names in country music. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
Wartime gossip, campaign strategy, and death threats are the broad subject headlines as we look ahead to the week in politics. The wartime gossip is to be found in Bob Woodward's new book, Plan of Attack. Woodward spoke with Mike Wallace on the CBS program 60 Minutes last night about the president's secret plan for Iraq, developed just weeks after 9/11.
President Bush, after a National Security Council meeting, takes Don Rumsfeld aside. Collars him physically and takes him into a little cubbyhole room and closes the door and says, what have you got in terms of plans for Iraq? What is the status of the war planning? I want you to get on it. I want you to keep it secret.
The campaign strategy headline comes from presumed Democratic nominee John F. Kerry. Tim Russert of NBC's Meet the Press asked him yesterday about democracy in Iraq.
Could you accept a Shiite theocracy running Iraq similar to what we have in Iran?
I think that what is important is to have a pluralistic representation. It doesn't have to be, at least in the early days, the kind of democracy this administration has talked about, though that's our goal.
And the final headline. Oh, yes, the death threats. Well, they were made against 9/11 Commission member Jamie Gorelick. Joining me to talk politics are Andrea Stone, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Hello, Andrea.
Hi.
And Jack Farrell, Washington bureau chief and assistant managing editor for the Denver Post. Hello, Jack.
Hello.
Let's start with the death threats. That's the real headline. This morning, our colleague at NPR, Nina Totenberg, had a report on the fallout from John Ashcroft's revealing last week that Jamie Gorelick may have actually been responsible for this wall between the security agencies and the FBI. It turns out that subsequent to that and the echo chamber effect in the right-wing press attacking Gorelick, she has had death threats on her house and her children, and the FBI is actually combing the area and trying to trace back her phone lines to find out who's done this. Now, is this some kind of news that warrants following up, in your view?
You know, I think that's pretty serious stuff, and I think it's an indication of how concerned the conservatives are about the effect these 9/11 hearings are going to have on the president's reelection.
Jack, now, is this something that you would have one of your reporters go and follow up on, or do you think that the story is out there as much as it's going to be, and the death threats are perhaps, something that aren't worth following up on?
Well, this is a white-hot emotional issue, and the five or six members of the victims' families of 9/11 sitting in the audience every day sort of adds to that emotionalism, and I think that when these clashes occur, they certainly can trigger somebody who's a little bit nutty and off his rocker, but it just seems very unfair to, in the same stream of reasoning, say the right-wing press, John Ashcroft's attack on Jamie Gorelick, are somehow responsible for this.
Let's move on to Bob Woodward's book, which has been dominating the news. Is there anything really new in the book that we didn't know already about the president's desire to go to war, perhaps well in advance of the UN process, and the weapons of mass destruction issues and so on?
I think that's a very good question, and there are some nuggets and tidbits that are new, as there always will be, because Woodward is such a great reporter. But the basic thrust of the book is just, it's reinforcing something that's been out there, and it all points to the same thing, which is that for whatever reason, W wanted to get us in war in Iraq, wanted to invade Iraq, and had begun planning it, and perhaps improperly, months before he leveled with the American people and said, now it's time to go.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. Former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill came out with a book a little while ago saying that Iraq was a subject from one of the first cabinet meetings of the administration long before 9/11. This book says that the president had decided in early of January 2003 that he's going to invade Iraq, which is 3 months before the official, when he officially said he was going to war after the UN process broke down. The White House is saying, no, that wasn't a decision. But, I think Woodward has done an admirable job. This was a book that the president sat down for 3 hours, I believe, of interviews. He gave the go-ahead to people in his administration to talk to Woodward. So this was really an authorized book. There were other things, like, for instance, Congress had authorized money for the war in Afghanistan, and the $700 million of that was diverted to prepare for Iraq. Nobody in Congress was told. So that you'll sure be hearing about that on Capitol Hill today and in the coming days.
And what about the notion that George Tenet, who was not quite as bold in front of the 9/11 Commission the other week, tells the president that weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that's a slam dunk. Don't worry about that one. And I say slam dunk in case listeners haven't actually read about this. Those are the words in his mouth, according to Bob Woodward.
I think a lot of people in Washington have been asking us, how does George Tenet survive? Now, how did he survive 9/11, let alone everything else? And people are really wondering how this guy kept his job.
Yeah, here's the question. Here's the question I got, which is that, what do you have to do to get fired by George W. Bush?
Exactly.
Well, this is we know one thing about his administration is he's a man who demands loyalty, and presumably he gives loyalty back. But let's move on to John Kerry, who made the obligatory spring appearance on Meet the Press. I suppose we can anticipate several more before Election Day. Went for an hour with Tim Russert. And towards the end of that hour was asked about the prospects for democracy in Iraq if a democratic vote in Iraq would, put in office an Iranian-style theocracy. And we heard a bit of that earlier. Is it wise for him to be talking about this stuff so far away from the election?
I think he handled himself pretty well on Russert. He was pretty forceful, and I think he answered the questions pretty right on, even when there were some embarrassing ones. And, I think the American public wants to know what he would do differently in Iraq. I mean, just last week, he had an op-ed piece about what he would do in Iraq, and I think he has to speak out on it, because that is the main issue of the campaign, it seems, so far.
I thought that what he was most skillful at yesterday was planting the suggestion that it may take a change of presidents. The world, the other foreign leaders, the United Nations, maybe even the Iraqis themselves, may just decide that the only way we're going to get out of this is the way that we got out of the Korean War, which is to elect a different administration, a different party, and take a fresh approach so that you don't have these built-up resentments and past history getting in the way. And I thought he was very deft at saying one point, almost parenthetically, you know, it just may take a change in president.
Jack Farrell, yes. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And Andrea Stone, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Jack Farrell is Washington Bureau Chief and Assistant Managing Editor for the Denver Post. Andrea Stone is Washington Correspondent for USA Today.
Still to come, the outfits, the muskets, the hair, the honor of reenacting the shot heard round the world.
You're listening to Here and Now.
There are over 20,000 runners in today's Boston Marathon, and as many stories. One belongs to number 21011. Gabriel Bol Akau, now 23, was one of the so-called Lost Boys of Sudan. After his Dinka family was slaughtered by Muslim tribesmen over 10 years ago, he walked thousands of miles with other Sudanese orphans to a Kenyan refugee camp. 3 years ago, he was relocated with other Dinkas to Massachusetts, and now he's going to travel another 26 or so miles with a very singular purpose. We spoke to Gabriel earlier and asked him, why is he running?
I'm running for brothers.
For brothers?
Yes.
Do you mean this as blood brothers or?
No, friend, in case to go to school and also for myself to go to school.
Let's tell people about that. This is a special foundation. It's called the Sudanese Education Fund.
Yes.
Which has been set up to help 170 lost boys in Boston.
Right.
And in the area, pay for tuition and school supplies and books.
Yes.
Yeah. This isn't the first time you've supported each other.
Yes.
You had to support each other when you made that horrendous walk in Africa. How far did you walk after your village was burned?
Actually, I took about a month.
A month. We understand that there were just thousands of
boys.
What was that like?
I was very young by then. I was 9 years old. Mm-hmm. What I remember only, it was horrible for me.
Horrible.
Yeah, because the sun shine, you know, and I don't have shoes. I just walk barefoot.
You walked barefoot?
Yes. A lot of the boys dies by hunger, and some have been eaten by animal.
Yeah.
And some have died by disease.
Yeah.
And other stuff.
Well, I don't have to tell you that it would seem that running 26 miles is probably nothing compared to the walk you've already done in Africa.
Absolutely, yes.
I've seen you training in the Boston area.
Uh-huh.
And there's some guys that I understand are cross-country runners at Neshoba High School, at the local high school.
Neshoba High School, yes. Uh-huh. They control me. Gabriel, don't run very fast. You know, you don't burn yourself.
They're afraid that you're not going to pace yourself well enough.
Yes.
Yeah. You've made many friends now outside Worcester, Massachusetts, actually, where you live.
Yes.
But what was it like when you first came here to the United States?
I came to America July 2001. So, and it was the summertime. And people say the weather was very hot, but for me, the weather was very cold.
So you came in the summer in July, but then what happened in the winter?
The snowfall, you know, but I never seen the snow before. Yes, it was hard for me to go out. I stay inside them.
Why?
Because, you know, it is a kind of scare. I never seen it before.
You think the sky was falling?
Sure.
What did you think when you saw your first Boston Marathon?
I thought the whole state was running.
You thought the whole state was running?
Yeah.
What do you think will happen if you raise this money?
When we have money, or if the boys go to school, the life will be changed, and we will start a new life.
Well, Gabriel, we wish you a lot of luck today.
Thank you.
Gabriel Bolacow, one of the lost boys of Sudan, running in today's marathon. We're coming.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Happy Patriots Day, a holiday celebrated only in Massachusetts with the running of the Boston Marathon. But of course, more important, an early morning reenactment of the Battle of Lexington and Concord, the shot heard round the world, a milestone in the road leading up to the American Revolution. Behind the yearly ritual is a complex organization, reenactors, and they're profiled in a new American Experience documentary called Patriots Day.
Damn your impudence! Straight down your arm!
You won't get my gun!
Clear the field! Make way! Quit the field!
We're joined in the studio by filmmaker Marion Marzinski, who made Patriots Day. Welcome.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Paul O'Shaughnessy, a reenactor who appears in the documentary, and I recognize you without your wig and what is it called? Tricornered hat?
Tricorn hat, that's correct.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And let's start with you, Paul. Who do you play?
Well, I play the commander of the 10th Regiment of Foot, but actually on the green I transform into Major John Pitcairn, who was there at that moment at the head of the column.
At the head of the British column.
Yes, that's correct.
And I realize when I say to Paul, Marion, who do you play, that's really not the way to say it. It's who do you embody? Because what did you learn about these reenactors?
Well, it depends who you're talking to. If you ask Paul, he'd probably say, we're just actors. When you ask some patriots, they may say, we are fulfilling our patriotic civic duty. And some even will say we are not actors, and we are doing this because we have to do it.
To them, there's obviously such power in playing, in many cases, the roles that their ancestors lived out earlier on. I mean, there's one scene where somebody talks about being in the shadow of his grandfather.
And I feel the fear. I really feel the fear. My stomach tightens. I caught sight of my shadow. And it was like my grandfather was walking beside me there.
They are stepping on the ground that this thing has happened, and then they are saying their names, which were the names of the people that they reenact. And I believe that at 5 o'clock in the morning, saying this other name is the most emotional point for them. It's sort of goosebumpy thing.
Yeah.
It's much more difficult act for Paul and for the British.
Well, Paul, I want to ask you about that because Marion suggested that maybe you see yourself as just an actor. But do you get into the minds and hearts of the British who were marching to Lexington and Concord to get some stores of ammunition, really didn't know what they were walking into?
Right. It's a different path. In our case, it's done through study. We were all brought up with an American education in these matters, so we step through the looking glass and try to see it from the other side. And what you discover is that the colonists were British and the British were American. It's all one. This was a civil war. And there are many parallels where these are soldiers out doing a task. They've been assigned to do it. They swore to duty that they would do it. All the same things that we hear today.
They're kind of tired, and they've just been told to march a long ways, and they're not sure it's early in the morning, and they're not sure why.
That's correct.
And as you said, there are many colonists who think that the Patriots, who are rising up against the British, are a bunch of rabble-rousers.
Absolutely.
I remember I lived in Lexington for a little while, and I remember being thrown out of my bed on the Patriots Day morning at 5 in the morning. I thought the town was under attack.
Give way! Give way! Quit the field! Elevate! Elevate!
It's quite startling the first time you see it. Marion, do you remember the first time you saw it?
Well, I first time saw it on camera, on my camera. I mean, this is the amazing thing about me and this subject is that this is not my history. I was born in Warsaw, but I knew that one day I must learn this history. Mm-hmm. And I learned it in the most fascinating way by touching somebody's uniform or somebody's equipment. Here is real. I understand him when he mm-hmm. says in the beginning, we are
Paul.
Stepping, right, Paul, we are stepping to the history. And his reservation about film was very well taken. He says, your camera is anachronism. And on the other hand, we would like to show the whole world. So how do we solve? Right. I'm curious to hear from him. How did we do, actually, this balance?
You've hit many points absolutely on the head, because we do this to bring it to life, to make it unlike what you read on the page. And yes, one of the big problems here was, how do we capture this without spoiling it in the process?
Yeah, and I think it succeeded beautifully.
I think that was the great pleasant shock, was how well that came out.
Marian, I want to ask you, you mentioned coming from Poland, lived in the United States for decades now, but I found it interesting to watch this film with the current events in my head. I'm hearing of insurgents in Iraq and conflicts around the world. I'm wondering, here, you put this together with perhaps current events, but also your country's past history in your head. How do you tell us how you view this moment on the Lexington Green through that prism?
When you have things like this, then you cannot help but think about that, what type of study it is. It is a study in patriotism. But what kind of patriotism? I come from Poland, where patriotism was a dirty word because it was used by the government to manipulate people.
And there are Iraqis right now who think that they are patriots.
Exactly. Now, I discovered during this film a term that I created, which I call a private patriotism, a patriotism that is inside the people because of their particular duty, of their sense of the land that they are. And this is a good patriotism. So I feel a sense, looking at this group, we have to make a distinction between, it's almost like a good cholesterol and bad cholesterol.
It's the patriotism that one wears on one's sleeve all of the time, or whether it's deep down inside.
Let me ask you, Paul, how does it make you feel when you do it? We watch what the reenactors go through. They carefully sew their costumes. They get just the right linen.
Now, you might ask, why am I wearing a fabric that's so difficult to come by? And the answer is because it itches and scratches, and I perspire exactly the same way that somebody would have under these weather conditions. And I can then say to you, not only do I look like this individual, I feel like him, and I'm reacting exactly the same way that somebody might have reacted, again, given these conditions.
How much time do you spend on this, would you say, and why, and how does it make you feel when you do it?
Well, I would say I probably spend too much time on this. It's, building up to this and the entire season, because this isn't the only thing we do, is probably my major avocation. And I'll leave it at that. But
why? Because people who make gentle fun of our dear reenactors here. We don't know we do without you on Patriots Day morning. But there you are in your powdered wigs and you're with your muskets. And
Why do we do it? That's an easy one. It takes me out of myself completely. This has got to be one of the most thrilling and unusual experiences on the face of the earth. I mean, who else does this? Mm. Who else goes out onto Lexington Green in the midst of 10,000 people and recreates a battle from 225 years ago?
And I would like to add something, that on the surface it looks like a vanity. Basically, the first thing is a bunch of vain people that like to dress. When you go closer, you actually find that this hobby is a very elegant and actually unselfish hobby, because the effort here is to be in touch with something that is untouchable almost. But I think that this going at the lengths to get in touch with something, and you know, it's a lot of humor, of course, because there is anachronism, and of course we are filming cell phones, despite
cell phones.
The fact that some patriot says, "Don't you dare to include it in your footage. This is a cell phone." I say, "Camera, continue." So, despite all these things, you know, you can see that there is this effort and this achievement of being in touch with something. And I think it's contagious. They have a sense that they're doing something great. And so this is what my story is, from vanity to the depths, to the idea.
To something greater than themselves.
Than yourself.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Filmmaker Marian Marzynski and reenactor Paul O'Shaughnessy. The American Experience film Patriots Day airs tonight on PBS stations across the country. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. And by the way, earlier I said Patriots Day was only celebrated here in Massachusetts. How could we forget our neighbors to the north? Happy Patriots Day up in Maine, where they're also celebrating.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.